Okay, friends, now we are moving on to Esoteric Astrology 117C, and we're on page 437. We've been dealing here with the three triangles. And DK is reviewing the three triangles. He just reviewed rather extensively the triangle of Capricorn. The main point in the triangle to follow, Mercury and humanity, and we are still in that review. We're relating it to the different aspects of mind, and I think to the three eyes, the right eye, the left eye, and the third eye. The crisis that Capricorn is precipitating, and the crumbling of the mountain load of karma, which is occurring in the world today. Okay. Now, he says here in pictorial language, I have endeavored to indicate the three streams of energy which meet in the center called humanity, and these are Pleiades, Capricorn, and Mercury. We see that there are relationships between these different groups and different groups of factors which are other than the ruling, the relationship caused by the rulers of different signs of the zodiac. So this involves, therefore, the active intelligence of man latent in the human center, the initiatory activity of Capricorn, and the illuminating radiance of Mercury. As far as the active intelligence goes, there is much of Mercury in that active intelligence. But also the fundamental energy of the Pleiades. So the active intelligence of man latent in the human center, drawn forth by the stream of energy from the Pleiades and through the various planetary logoi and finally to the Earth, the initiatory activity of Capricorn also producing much destruction, which is incident to liberation, and the illumining radiance of Mercury, really, which is ruling all five aspects of the mind, and the illumination is coming particularly from the transcendental mind, we call it, which is the Buddhi, the intuitive mind, and also perhaps even from that factor we call the atmic mind, where mind and law and will are one. This combination is, he's really going into it, isn't he? Because it's such a potent triangle at this particular time, although its highest expression may already have passed. We have to read about that. These things are, these coming togethers are temporary in time and space, and we have to see how temporary. This combination of energies produces a triplicity of activity of extreme importance today. He's really telling us about everything that's lying behind the unfoldment of events in the outer world. Okay. Triangle 2 has been called the triangle of the advanced man. He seems to be beginning and working backwards or upwards from the third triangle to the second and then to the first. So this is the triangle of the advanced man. It involves the second aspect of divinity. Turning here to the picture, we see Pisces, Uranus, and hierarchy, the triangle of the advanced man. And we know it depends on what we mean by the advanced man. Sometimes we can mean the individual who has not yet begun to take initiations, and sometimes we can use that term to extend all the way into the area of initiation. Okay, just going to pause for just a moment here. All right, let us move ahead. Had a little microphone issue there. Triangle 2, the triangle of the advanced man. Who is the advanced man? Is it the disciple, almost the disciple, or one who is in fact the initiate? It is a term that can be applied across the board. It is associated with the kingdom of souls, with the fifth kingdom in nature as it relates to the fourth. So all of these factors, Sirius, Pisces, and Uranus, all are involved in the induction of man from the fourth kingdom into the fifth kingdom. It is this triplicity of forces which playing on triangle 3, we might say as Sirius plays upon the Pleiades in a way, as Uranus plays upon Mercury, well, there's a definite connection because one is the higher octave of the other, and as Pisces plays upon the sign Capricorn, generally Pisces considered a sign with more ultimate results than Capricorn, playing upon triangle 3 attracts out of it, notice the law of attraction here, okay, the law of attraction involved in triangle 2, okay, out of it those units of energy which, as a result of the activity of Capricorn, Mercury, and humanity itself, are ready to come under hierarchical influence, and to be swayed consequently by different streams of force to those hitherto evoking response. And we noticed when we looked at the old commentary up here, here it was, yes, right here, that the little one, okay, the hierarchy of light emerged from its own place. That's what I'm talking about. That's that drawing out of the center we call humanity of those who can enter as stimulated lights into the hierarchy of light. Okay. Right. So attracts out of it those units of energy which, as a result of the activity of Capricorn, Mercury, and humanity itself, preparatory, a long stage of preparatory work, are ready to come under hierarchical influence and to be swayed consequently by different streams of force than those hitherto evoking response. Okay, so this, we begin here with, in a way, with Pisces, directly responsive to Sirius. Pisces is particularly potent at present in the life of humanity owing to its being the sign which is now passing out of influence as we progress upon the great wheel of the zodiac. It's passing out of influence in two ways we realize. One, in terms of the 2,500-year cycle, or sometimes called the 2,160-year precessional cycle. Its influence is almost completed now, and by the end of the present century, the DK tells us, its influence will be removed. But then there is the larger Piscean cycle in which we have been involved some 25,000 years. The great Platonic years appear to pass also in clockwise fashion around the zodiac. And as we noticed even earlier, there was a 250,000-year cycle, which as well seems related to the signs or the constellations of the zodiac. Interesting. Okay. Passing out of influence as we progress upon the great wheel of the zodiac. It is this sign with its combination of energies, and notice that every sign has a combination of energies within itself and also in terms of the planets which rule it, which has produced such a potent vibratory activity in humanity that it can successfully and eventually enact the role of the world savior. Come forward to the mountaintop, and on its summit learn the invocation of a Savior. In the far distance stands a mountain blue. Stood a mountain blue, and from its summit issued forth a voice which said, come forward to the mountaintop, and from its summit learn the invocation of a Savior. And that is the law of repulse of the sixth ray, preparing the sixth ray type eventually to become a second ray type. At least a number of them do, if they don't become third ray types, and become world saviors. So humanity itself subjected to redemptive education in Pisces can become the world savior. Of this salvation, Pisces is the sign. And what I'd like to, salvation in a certain sense, I'd like to call it, is the turn to the archetype. Because when all things are arranged in love and according to pure reason and according to the pattern which is purpose, there is salvation. Pisces is also the sign of death. It's so strongly related to Pluto, we know, and Neptune is the bringer of pralaya, is an important, pralaya is death, bringing an important rulership in the larger sense to Pisces. And it is its death aspect. In its death aspect, we see the Piscean correspondence to the first aspect, the destroyer aspect of the Logos. We know there is Ray 1, Ray 2, and Ray 6 transmitted through Pisces. We might also wonder whether there is a constellational transmission of the first ray. Certainly, some of the really terrible people bringing death to many had strong Pisces indications. I'm thinking of certain Nazis. Eichmann was one of them, and Reinhard Heydrich was another. They were both involved in the Final Solution. Final Solution, think about that. Final Dissolution. And think about the role of Pisces there, and Pluto as the ruler of Pisces. This death aspect is naturally active at the close of the Piscean Age, which we are now experiencing, and is consequently bringing about the present death of form in all the three worlds. Things are falling apart in terms of their old structure, and that is good because it's clearing the way for future possibilities. Yes. Okay, so, you know, always there seem to be one or two rays missing from the expression of the Lord of the Constellation. They aren't emphasized necessarily in this world period. What actually are there? Are they? That is the question. Uranus is, which at first does not seem to have much of a relation to Pisces except in the factor of liberation, and in its glyph, and in the idea that oneness is realized in both, oneness in time, simultaneity, and perhaps oneness in space, overcoming the Saturnian divisions with Uranus, and the fusion of all factors in the synthetic one, that's Piscean. Uranus is the planet of occultism, for it veils that which is essential. I suppose the spirit aspect itself, that which is of the essence. It hides that which must be discovered at the right moment, and at the right moment, it transmits knowledge of the hidden mystery. Remember, from one perspective, Uranus is the planet of the Hierophant, especially. Third initiation and beyond. So Sanat Kumara, the Great Awakener, is in many ways playing the role of Uranus at that first of initiations over which he officiates the third initiation. Uranus is the planet of occultism, for it veils that which is essential, it hides that which must be discovered, and at the right moment it transmits knowledge of the hidden mystery. A mystery is sufficiently recessed, and if it's a hidden mystery, it must be deeply recessed. I'm reminded of the first purpose of Sanat Kumara, which is so deeply so deeply hidden, and which it is the function of all true esoteric schools one day to reveal. And Master Mori is connected with that. Master Mori is connected with Uranus in a way in that it rules Aries with hierarchically, which is the sign with which he is most identified. Uranus also can be connected, I think, with the sea of fire. When I look at the Leo rulership there, I know it veils Vulcan to a certain extent, but I can't help but think that Uranus is involved in the ultimate archetypes, as far as the cosmic physical plane is concerned, of the Logoid plane. Today, for the mass of men, occultism is non-existent. It's not within their purview. It's not something they think about, and we have to bring it to the point where they can think about it in a way that is not frightening or repelling, but attractive. For the aspirant and disciple, well, in other words, the mass of men are not Uranian in that sense. Uranus can also represent some form of advancing science, which ordinary humanity can't respond to, but that's one of the lower expressions of its nature. Occult science is its true expression in one way, and electric fire and liberation are still higher expression. Today, for the mass of men, occultism is non-existent. For the aspirant and the disciple, occultism is rapidly becoming a source and system of revelation as they penetrate into the wisdom of the hierarchy. And in the lightning flash, Uranus reveals the hidden structure of things. Yeah, and you know, if you think about it, in Pisces, the final veils are lifted. In the beginning, it's a sign of great veiling. It's material and it obscures the spirit, but later it reveals the spirit, and Uranus does the same thing. So we might say that Pisces and Uranus are similar in that they are involved with final revelations, the end of illusion of time and space. It's all dissolved in Pisces, and it's suddenly fused in Uranus. All the many spaces with, let's put it like this, with Uranus, all the many spaces become one space, and all the many times one time. The planet above all of simultaneity and of the fusion of separate perceptions into one perception, we might say of Uranus. Of Uranus, the fusion of many separate perceptions into one perception. It's almost like the all-seeing eye is somehow involved here, because, you know, there is a certain, with Uranus, well, with Pisces too, there is the principle of ubiquity, everywhereness, you know, omnipresence, and omnipotence as well, and omniscience. It is a planet which rules the cosmic ethers, on which, or in relation to which, or through the experience of which, the three factors of deity, omnipresence, omniscience, and omnipotence begin to be attracted to the human being and factors in the life of the advancing human being. Not yet complete, of course, because we've got system after system in which all over again these things have to be achieved. Omnipresence, omniscience, and omnipotence. One can have those with respect to any particular whole and not with still more embracing holes. So, the triangle of Pisces-Uranus hierarchy is becoming magnetically attractive to the triangle of humanity, and really what we're dealing with here, these are not independent lines of descending force, but are interactive. We're dealing with the interactivity of different triangles of energy, And humanity indeed is being invoked and evoked by hierarchy. The call has gone forth and there is a response. Uranus and Mercury in combination are dualities. One the higher octave of the other. They're really a pair. And Mercury dissolves into Uranus eventually in its subtle principles. Uranus and Mercury in combination are dualities which the disciple learns to resolve. And in the process of this resolution, he shifts his focus out of the human kingdom into the fifth kingdom, the hierarchy of souls. Not just the kingdom, but the hierarchy of souls. So indeed, Uranus, being the ruler of Aquarius, which of all signs most characterizes hierarchy, maybe as Pisces most characterizes Shambhala from a salvational perspective, Uranus has, as the ruler, the main ruler of Aquarius, because it also is a veiled ruler of the moon, one of them, is also therefore a planet related to the hierarchy because of its rulership of Aquarius. So Mercury, of course, can also lead into the hierarchy in different ways, but Mercury is very much humanity and the human mind, the monastic approach to all things, especially the concrete approach. And then when higher Mercury begins, we get those kinds of perceptions which lead towards the unity of vision and realization. And Mercury leads towards Uranus. Putting things together in relationship one day gives us that snap of intuition which is not only advanced in a Mercurian way, but carries the vibration of Uranus, the sudden perception of Uranus. Suddenly you know. Intuition strikes, or the higher forces strike Uranus, in a way, the planet of realization. Pisces and Capricorn in unison bring about those changes which lift the disciple out of the waters wherein he is rapidly drowning onto the mountaintop whence he can watch the recession of the waters. But notice here, the order is reversed. Because in this context, in this context, Pisces should be the greater energy. And we could say that it lifts the initiate in Capricorn towards a world saviorship, or towards such a vast service that occurs through identification. So the man knows himself initiate in Capricorn, and he knows himself the world savior in Pisces. So in a way, Pisces is lower, because it represents the astral waters and all of the Kama monastic responses which have to be dried up in that maybe driest of all signs in some ways, Capricorn, although it also has to do with water and its ruler Saturn rules the atmic plane in relation to which the term water is used, and Capricorn is the goat fish and the one who crosses the water. But he crosses the water, that's the point, and he manages to emerge from all the Piscean astral sensitivity. And yet Pisces is also saviorship, which raises the initiate to an even higher status in the principle of love. A great light breaks forth at the third degree, but increasingly at the fourth, where Pisces is powerful, and at the fifth, where it's also powerful, the love is added to the light. The present world crisis should and will see a close merging of the two triangles. So what is our principle here? Principle is crisis brings merging. In a most potent manner, in this partial synchronization, only that, or close though it may be, it will not yet be a process of general identification. We still have a long way to go. Will produce the sixfold energy needed to bring in the new sixth root race. How interesting. How interesting. Six energies and the, let's just say, six fusing energies and the sixth root race. And the new world period wherein fellowship and brotherhood will be manifest in all human relations. It's going to be a 10 million year root race, we understand, with its inevitable divisions. We're not there yet, and maybe we have to pass through the age of Aquarius before, maybe in the age of Capricorn, the sixth root race can really begin to emerge. And it is the sixth sub-race of the present fifth root race which will give the bridge or the segue into the sixth, actual sixth root race. Everything is purely reasonable in so many ways. We see here how the attraction exerted by the hierarchical triangle upon the human triangle produces a fusion which brings in the sixth root race. Apparently unrelated factors, but really closely related to those who have the hierarchical vision, which Master DK is sharing with us. Okay, triangle one. All right, now let's look at that one again. There it is, Leo, Saturn, Shambhala. With the fusing triangle, 2 and 3. Yes, it is interesting that DK chose to emphasize the lower part of Pisces related to the astral plane. We have to remember also that it's related to pure love and to the cosmic astral plane through which the brilliance of Sirius descended into that Piscean field. Anything ruled by Neptune entrains Pisces. So if you think about it, we've got with the astral plane a Pisces-Neptune connection. We've got with the Buddhic plane Pisces-Neptune. We have with the monadic plane Pisces-Neptune connection. The monad is the savior, and Pisces leaves the father's home and turning back and saves. And then the cosmic astral plane, Pisces and Neptune again. So that's higher in a certain way than Capricorn or Saturn, though these energies do play leapfrog with each other. And, you know, the dense concretion of Saturn-Capricorn underneath the astral Pisces is a lowercase, and Pisces lifts people out of that hard insensitivity into a state of at least responsiveness, which begins to sensitize them to the possibility of higher energies. Well, triangle one, he goes in reverse order, is produced by the interrelation of energies from Leo, Saturn, and Shambhala, with the Great Bear behind it all. And we remember we talked about how in astronomical space the Great Bear and Leo are so contiguous. They're right there together. Its potency is naturally felt more directly in the triangle of the hierarchy than that of humanity, because hierarchy is approaching Shambhala now, a very important approach, and Shambhala is working through hierarchy. We did look at those, that triangle of Shambhala hierarchy and humanity, and the double arrows, which are the eventual result, giving the interactive reciprocity of all the centers. Shambhala with hierarchy, Shambhala with humanity, humanity with hierarchy. These three energies are sometimes called, in an effort to make understanding more easy and to simplify it, the triple energy of will. You can just imagine the sophistication of interrelation that Master DK sees, and the hopeless futility of conveying all of that subtle nexus to humanity as presently constituted. We just don't get it yet. I have to laugh every time he talks about the learned but dense esotericist, or aspirant, is it? Learned but dense. Let me look at those words just for a moment. I want to see where that comes from, if I can find it, you know. Learned, dense. Learned and dense together. Dense physical and anything more? Number 5. It's not to be revealed at the moment, but maybe the word is not learned, you know. Anyway, he talked about, well, let's just see. Dense, aspirant. I'm doing this on behalf of all of us, who no doubt, in certain ways, are just that. As much as we may be learning, we still have our own density to deal with. Mm-hmm. Well, it might not be aspirant. It might not be aspirant. Might be student of esotericism. Well, you just have to trust me for that. I don't have it exactly here. Wish I did. But the idea is dense. I feel a little dense not being able to find it, but okay. The triple energy of will. The will of self-determination, well, that's... The will of self-determination, it depends on what level of the self we're talking about. You can be self-determining on a very low level. The will of sacrifice, and so, you know, what is the type of will connected with the soul? The sacrificial will of the soul, yes? Sacrificial will of the soul and the will to choose under Saturn. And all of these are aspects of a triple, of a will that has three parts to it. What's higher, what's lower, it depends on how we place these. Somehow I'm always interested in hierarchical thinking. What has greater power? What has greater priority? What is higher or lower in any ranking? Pisces connected with the soul here. Capricorn, I suppose, with humanity, which must choose and to go the higher way. And self-determination can be occurring on any of the three levels that Leo represents, including the self-determination of the monad, which decides to descend for sacrificial purposes. So let's see how he develops this. Because the Shambhala force lies behind the other two triangles and is the recipient of energy from the three above constellations. It seems that all three affect Shambhala. Well, it is the place where energies gather under the law of assembly. All three energies are here found in Shambhala. Okay. The recipient of energy from the three constellations, blending them into the united expression of will. So if it has to do with Shambhala, it has to do with will, and it's not simply that these constellations are the head of their respective lines, because in a way, think about it, some of these higher reaches, the planetary reach and the zodiacal reach, and certainly the reach of the three great constellations is higher than Shambhala could possibly be. So three aspects of the will here, the will to choose, to sacrifice, and to determine freely. Of course, that sounds quite Uranian in a way. The will of sacrifice and the will of self-determination, Leo. DK makes much of the self-determining nature of the Leo individual. He talks about it almost in a humorous way when we think about the average Leo individual, you know, of whom it can be said, you can always tell a Leo, but you can't tell them much. Well, that's on the strictly personality level. From another point of view, that's not the case at all. But self-determination under Uranus, as the veiled hierarchical ruler of Leo, Uranus has a lot to do with Leo, but not in this particular context. Uranus is a very self-determining planet. It's the planet of the deepest type of freedom of the individuality or of the true being. But we're talking of the Saturn nature of it here and not the Uranian nature. The Shambhala force lies behind the other two triangles and is the recipient of energy from the three above constellations, blending them into the united expression of will. And thus Shambhala proves to be the custodian of divine purpose. Sometimes when I think about the what we call the cosmic ethers, I think in one way, let's see if I can find this. Yeah, there it is. That purpose is resident in some ways upon the second plane, and will in its purest form upon the first. But these words are used in not only in distinctive ways, but in ways which cross over. So sometimes the use of the word will implies purpose. Anyway, a purpose has a secondary quality to it in relation to the first ray for me, because it always represents a pattern, and the second ray is the ray of the divine pattern. That's my reasoning there. And will is the servant, in one way, of purpose, making sure that it is brought into expression. So Shambhala is the custodian of divine purpose. The triangles of which the hierarchy and humanity are the expression are becoming responsive to Shambhala. This is true in an exoteric sense and an esoteric sense. Esoterically and occultly, hierarchy is becoming newly responsive to Shambhala as it reorients itself towards Shambhala, even while reorienting towards humanity, which we as disciples also have to do on a lesser, in a lesser way. And humanity is being hit by Shambhala impacts in an unmediated form. And so sometimes these heavy impacts really evoke not only a reaction, but a response. A response is better and more considered. A reaction is just based upon the past. So those who are reactionary are rooted in the past. So both of these triangles are becoming responsive to Shambhala, the hierarchical center greatly so, and the human center gradually so. I mean, we don't really think about the quite great distance which actually exists between hierarchy and Shambhala. We sometimes fail to realize that. And yet, what's some analogy that Master DK used about the difference between Sanatkumara and the average master being like the difference between a master and a savage human being, one who's just emerged into the human kingdom. Maybe there aren't so many now, because we all have, we're told, at least one petal of the egoic lotus open, but that is the analogy as I remember it. So Shambhala is quite a bit in advance of the hierarchical status. Of course, we lose the proportion. The master may loom so large in our field of vision that we forget that compared to greater lives, he's a small being. This first or fundamental triangle, fundamental is occult, in the truest sense of the word, to even the trained occultist and to the majority of the members of the hierarchy. Goodness. So, you would say, it is an occult triangle, even to members of the to those who have achieved the fifth degree. Therefore, only a few points can be mentioned in connection with it, as there is little to be found in even the advanced disciple with which to reach real understanding. It's good that DK clarifies this for us. Sometimes he might present certain energies, and through familiarity we think we know something about them, but what is really suggested is something way beyond our ken, and we're only picking up some superficial indications. The information must perforce remain academic and theoretical. It is a step along the way, necessary, I think, in many cases, but obviously not the fulfillment of knowledge. Real knowledge, not just that which the mind can organize into apparently meaningful patterns. Okay, so how does it go? Leo, which is the will of the self-conscious entity, capital E, to manifest, holds the clue or key to the entire problem of self-conscious being. Who is that self-conscious entity? Is it the monad? Is it the soul? Whether it is the will to be of a planetary logos, perhaps the will to exist in a certain field of matter, or of a group, or of a man. It's coming from a high place, this type of will to manifest, as oneself, manifest in a lower place as oneself. So this can be coming related to high beings or to lower beings, and it's not only related to the personality. The self-consciousness of man is inherent in the planet itself. I suppose in the planetary logos is will to exist or will to be, which is the life expression of a fully self-conscious being. And by this we mean the planetary logos. So we are parts, monadically, temporarily at least, a part of the planetary logos, and as he wills to manifest, as he selected an area of space and association with certain beings in which and through whom to manifest, we are doing something similar. And his great impulse to redeem the lesser lives is part of our monadic impulse because we are part of him. Him, her, you know, at that point it's a union, isn't it? Depending on whether there's a masculine or feminine polarization, still there is a union of the two aspects in these higher beings. The self-consciousness of man is inherent in the planet itself. So, you know, we cannot say that monads are not self-conscious. Sometimes I seem to get that from Blavatsky, that a spirit is just a passive something. But to me, the monad is a unit which has its very definite history and its own self-awareness within the context of group awareness and even of awareness within the one, but it still knows itself as a center, and somewhere DK does discuss that, the point and the circle. The life expression of fully self-conscious being. The use of the will through the Shambhala center involves the conscious use of that energy by the planetary logos. So the planetary logos consciously uses the will. And this is evoking response today from the world of men in terms of will, both higher and lower. It seems that not only is it time for the planetary logos to open the heart center and to become to become expressive of his own secondary soul, but his will is also being exerted to that end. So the use of the will through the Shambhala center, which involves the logoic plane here, involves the conscious use of that energy of will by the planetary logos, and because the logos is willing from and through Shambhala, though, you know, the logos is focused also on the cosmic planes and uses Shambhala, we are receiving this energy. The willful, self-willed man of the world, who can be connected, you know, with many things, with Leo, with Taurus, with Capricorn, with Vulcan, and so forth, is apt to be more responsive to the Shambhala force than is the disciple or the aspirant because they are more attuned to the gentler vibration of the hierarchy. So this lower type of human being, we're not talking about a willful member of the hierarchy, this is the man of the world who is not being encumbered by the energy of love, not being restrained from accomplishing his selfish purposes by sensitivity to the Sirian line, but is along the Great Bear line, which involves the willful planet Vulcan. There is a connection there, isn't there, between the Great Bear and the Sun and Vulcan, or Great Bear, Leo, Sun, and Vulcan. That is a transmission. The willful, self-willed man of the world is apt to be more responsive to the Shambhala force than is the disciple or aspirant because they are more attuned to the gentler vibration of hierarchy, the great buffer, in a sense. Now, we are receiving, you know, unbuffered Shambhala force. Are you troubled by Shambhala force? Then take this hierarchical buffer. But now it is being removed, you know. I'm recalling this, you know. They used to give people aspirin to relieve certain kinds of pain, but it caused trouble in the stomach. Remember, we're just a little cell or atom in some abdominal organ, and so bufferin was added years ago to buffer the effect of the greater force. I've told you earlier that this Leo force from Shambhala is finding direct entry into the human center instead of indirectly via the hierarchy, as has hitherto been the case. Well, you know, there's a double Leo here, isn't there? Because, you know, Leo is said to be the most human of all the signs. And here it is connected with Shambhala, connected with the logoic plane on which Shambhala has its highest council. So there is a direct line, isn't there? It's almost like a descent that goes like this. It goes, in a sense, Leo, Aquarius, Leo. Well, Leo, Shambhala, Aquarius, hierarchy, Leo again, for humanity, from one perspective. This is a different way of thinking. And another way, it's going Leo, Pisces, Leo, with Shambhala and humanity both representing Leo at different turns of the spiral. And Aquarius, Aquarius, Pisces can be considered as sort of an overlapping duality. Even as constellations, they do overlap through that thing called the band, that constellation called the band between the fishes. Now, it goes to Saturn. This energy is primarily concerned with presenting opportunity to the hierarchy and its affiliated disciples. I doubt that the average man considers what Saturn presents as opportunity, but, you know, the old saying from Master Moria, the worse the better. Hard for those who are not on the first ray to see such obstacles as possibilities. So presenting opportunities to the hierarchy particularly, and that's for detachment and disengagement and affiliation with the plan and with the law and with the purpose, which finally gets rid of the encumbrance of our usual perceptions, usual sensory perceptions inclined towards materialism. So Saturn, which is a very material planet, offers kind of a break from materialism. It takes us through detachment away from our normal perceptions with which we identify. The phrase that Saturn is the planet of discipleship, and thus when we're interpreting our charts, we should really observe its placement. Saturn is the planet of discipleship is basically true because ordinary average man, except in group formation, does not come so potently under its influence. Well, at least in terms of spiritual opportunity. There are, except, I just want to say, you know, except for karmic factors. And then there is that type of influence. For the hierarchy as a group is facing a great crisis of approach to Shambhala. Analogous to that confronting humanity today as it seeks to approach and contact the hierarchy. Everything's moving up. The Capricorn law is the law of group progress. Hierarchy is a group. Humanity and its discipleship ranks forms a kind of group. The new group of world servers moving upward. Yes. A great crisis. I suppose we do not appreciate the degree to which hierarchy experiences its crisis. We're pretty anthropocentric, and we are worried about our own crises. Then it seems to us as if the members of hierarchy have mastered everything, and they have no worries, no challenges. But Master Hilarion reminds us that even the great master can fall back at a high point and retreat in failure before the requirement before him, before the next initiatory step. I suppose, you know, planetary logoi fail. Maybe solar logoi fail temporarily in time and space. In the end, I suspect there is success for all because it's only one thing. So if you can't divide the one thing, how can there be success for a part and not for the whole? But that's dealing with the ultimate pralaya, I would say. Facing a great crisis of approach to Shambhala, analogous to that confronting humanity today as it seeks approach and contact with the hierarchy. Thus, there are two interrelated crises affecting both humanity and the hierarchy. Because as humanity, as the hierarchy moves up, its places must be taken by human beings who must qualify to do so. And only through crisis and taking oneself truly in hand and getting rid of the bonds and the veils and the fetters and all that hold us to lesser perceptions, only thus will we succeed in being worthy of taking our place in hierarchy. Thus there are two interrelated crises affecting both humanity and hierarchy, and these should produce, if correctly effected, brought about, that which is called alignment or integration, resulting in a far freer flow of divine energy, I suppose, between all the centers. I mean, just imagine, hierarchy aligns more definitely with Shambhala, which it does at the various great festivals. I suppose the Taurus Festival of Waisak, even the Gemini Festival, where the Buddha and the Christ are both participating in a sense, and the Festival of Leo, where the entire hierarchy is recognized as a body, including all of its newly inducted members. There is a hierarchical relationship to Shambhala, and then humanity is attempting to relate to hierarchy. So inevitably, there is a flow through these relationships, which amount to an alignment, encouraging that flow. Both these approaches, which are in the nature of magnetic attractive pulls, we might say, by the higher upon the lower, are conditioned by Saturn. How very interesting. Because we can understand that a man has to overcome his karma and get in line with the divine plan in order to rise into the potential of being related to the hierarchy, but so must hierarchical members conform to the laws and requirements of Shambhala. So members of hierarchy must, and that's the word, conform to the new and higher requirements of Shambhala. So let's see, though, how he looks at this. In this case of humanity, this pull comes via the hierarchy. And apart from that hierarchy, mankind cannot today totally surmount or properly handle the crisis. So we need the reappearance of the Christ. We need the externalization of the hierarchy. It's just too much for us to handle. And as Master Moria says, must I shout it in your ears, hierarchy. That's pretty well the exact quote, maybe a word or two different there, but it's basically about shouting, ears, and hierarchy. And this should be remembered and should speed the work of disciples and aspirants of the world as they struggle. For human liberation, there's Uranus, and to bring about divine intervention. So, you know, what are we doing here about this? Preparing the way for the reappearance of the Christ. The intervention desired should come via the hierarchy, if it is not to be too destructive in its effect. Well, we've had some Shambhala impacts. I don't know to what extent they've been buffered. We're told that Shambhala measures its impact, you know, the finger of God, the yod, the power that touches and then withdraws. If don't keep your hand in the, your finger in the electric socket there. Of course, it's it would destroy the forms. It's a bit of the reverse. I mean, Shambhala is the electric socket, you know. We can only stand so much of exposure to this electric fire. So there will be an intervention through the externalization of the hierarchy, but there are impacts, and we're getting shaken up in a Uranian way, and Uranus having a lot to do with the logoic plane and with Shambhala and with the archetype and with the great authentic being and purpose. The last major intervention in Atlantis came via Shambhala and resulted in the partial destruction of entire continents and lands. Well, we hear that the world was submerged, but those who know the specific details would probably tell us that it was not all of the world, because after all, he tells us that the United States, the American continent, or the country, the landmass, which is the country, was the center of the old Atlantean continent. doesn't seem to be submerged, does it? Unless it reemerged after that point. That's also possible to a degree, as some of those western deserts were once underwater. Well, I don't know my geology well enough to comment on that, but I have a good friend who's a geologist, Daniel Krumenacher, also a very earnest student of this teaching, and I suppose he could answer to this. He's always presenting me with the scientific perspective and, you know, arguing for the validity of that and trying to reconcile the strictly hierarchical esoteric perspective with the best that science has to offer. So the last major intervention in Atlantean days came via Shambhala. And I suppose there was an intervention in Lemurian days. Was it Shambhalic? I think so. And it was the bringer of volcanic destruction for much of the Lemurian civilization. But I think that those in Shambhala are careful to measure the application of their force. And Noah, Philip Lindsay, he could tell us more about Noah, but one of the Manus, was told, I think, to make sure that there were those who could be saved and brought to lands that were safe before the flood was released. On our planet, there's a lot of destruction of forms. We do live on an essentially first-rate planet from its monadic aspect, and even though that ray is occultly non-effective at the present time because this is a non-sacred planet, still it somehow penetrates the very substance of our planetary process. And the birthing by a third ray of a multitude of forms and their destruction in the struggle for survival, which is meant to produce finally the best forms, cannot be denied. And of course it's the intervention now of that second ray which brings these two into alignment and into accord. We do need the planetary heart to emerge, which is the hierarchy. We do need the emergence of the soul ray of our planet, which is the second ray. And in that way, Shambhala energy or force can be more wisely applied to the level of form where there is such constant mutability. But maybe we'll be able to do that in a more intelligent manner, and people will be able to cooperate with the necessary change of form which connects with the archetypes that are to be instituted in the lower or mosaic worlds, as I like to call them. Well, we're getting there. So these three triangles of energy can therefore be seen as basic and determining in all planetary affairs and event producing, because they work their way all the way down into the three planetary centers and into the chakras of the human being. And those chakras are going to produce outer events, actions, you might say. I have consequently chosen to consider them in our efforts to comprehend this basic astrological science. He keeps on talking about how fundamental it is, how basic is this astrological science, and we want to understand the foundation for our thought, which is now being offered to us. I think we've been pretty square in a way. We've been thinking in squares. Our etheric body on this planet has a lot of squares, but it's to be transmuted or transformed into a triangular configuration, the so-called bisecting of the square, which I think Pythagoras taught to Master DK in an esoteric manner. Somewhere in the teaching we hear about how a master or a teacher taught the bisecting of the square, which is changing the square into two triangles. So there'll be twice as many triangles as there have been squares. Perhaps for sacred planets, the etheric body is already filled with triangles. And perhaps for the sun, well, he said it's supposed to be a series of circles or the interlocking circles. It makes sense. Squares for the non-sacred planets, triangles for the sacred planets, and circles for the sun. God geometrizes this, we are taught, and it actually is going to be shown to be working out in our study of matter. If you've studied a little bit of Leadbeater's and Besant's occult chemistry, you see how very geometrical they perceive the organization of matter. I think science has to catch up with them in a way. Yes, let's see where we were here. Okay. Well, all right, I think we've gone far enough, and I'm hoping there was a little... I usually take my timing off this particular little rectangle, but it looks like that may have been on when I was making some other adjustments in sound. So this is the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 117C, and we're on page 441. Page 441, and beginning, I think, if I go on tonight, I'm not sure, 1118A, page 441. Okay, friends, so this brings us to a conclusion of this little series. And what a book, what a book. Helping us live more scientifically and with respectful recognition of the intricacy of the macrocosm in which we are living and moving and have our being. There are many of those in whom we live and move and have our being. Planetary logos is one, and the solar logos another, and the cosmic logos another, and the one about whom not to be said another, and somehow Master DK is filling in enough relationships so at least we can grasp something of the interplay within those greater spheres in which we live and move and have our being. Okay, we'll see you soon.